to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I can give you maybe a little bit more of background about who I am. When I first came to Boston, I was a master's student. I joined the MIT Wearable Computing Group back in 2001. And in 2001, wearable computing meant literally strapping a computer to your back and a head-mounted display to your head. And you see these guys walking around campus in Boston collecting really interesting data about their own behavior and their environment, but kind of much to the amusement of the people who were watching these guys walk around with these computers strapped to their bodies. And it didn't help. They referred to themselves as the Borg. So I joined the Borg Lab in 2001 and immediately started trying to scheme ways of avoiding strapping computers to myself, mainly out of trying to avoid this humiliation. And luckily, because this was 2001, this coincided with when Nokia launched one of their first mainstream programmable phones. And so I made a deal with my advisor, Sandy Pentland, who I think many of you guys work with, and at least most of you know, that if I could capture similar types of data on the phone, I wouldn't have to spend the rest of my graduate career dressing up like a computer. And he graciously agreed, and I've been hacking on phones ever since. When I finished my PhD at MIT on building machine learning algorithms that can deal with the magnitude of data coming from mobile phones, I wanted to start thinking about how I could develop mobile apps that would really make an impact. I had started a company earlier that connected socially awkward singles in Manhattan together, and while that was a fun time, it was recently acquired actually about a year ago. Well, that was fun. That was really. I felt like there's more there. There's more impact that we could do. And the mobile phones, they weren't necessarily having the impact that I wanted them to have here in the States or in Finland or Korea for that matter. But it was just taking off in Africa. And so I moved to East Africa, to Kenya in 2006, and I've been living and working there ever since. Luckily, I was able to hold on to a job as kind of a part of the research faculty at MIT. But instead of having my office down the street, I was living in a small village called Kilifi out on the coast. And I was a Fulbright professor at the University of Nairobi teaching mobile phone programming. And what's really exciting, and this is the only time I'm going to be able to talk about it. So I'll spend a minute talking about EEPROM. This is a program that we launched in 2006, a mobile phone programming curriculum that is enabling computer science students to develop mobile apps across Africa. And the exciting thing is that now EEPROM is in 12 countries across sub-Saharan Africa. Literally thousands of African computer science students have gone through the program, and the program has generated many hundreds of mobile apps designed specifically for the African market. As well as quite a few startups based in Nairobi, Addis Ababa, and elsewhere. One such startup that I will talk about at the end of this talk is TextEagle. It's my company. It's based in, we have an office in San Francisco and it's based mainly out of Nairobi. And what that company does is it enables people to earn small amounts of money on their mobile phones by completing simple tasks for our clients who include companies like Microsoft and Google and Nokia. What's interesting is that TextEagle was more or less an idea about a year ago, and we're now in kind of a global launch mode where we've got a huge number of users, and I've found myself running what is now a multi-million dollar corporation. But to get something like this off the ground, you really need to be intimate with the mobile phone operators. And so and while I was living in East Africa, I started working with literally every mobile phone operator in that region, and I have relationships with dozens of operators around the world. And what I do for them is I help them analyze CDR. And I'm going to spend at least half the talk talking about CDR. CDR is call data records. It's the digital trace that you leave behind anytime you check your balance or send a text message or someone calls you. And what the operators are interested in is gaining some insight into their subscriber base. But so I help them do that. But at the same time, this type of data, this is being generated on such a scale that it can really add some value to these underserved and understudied populations all over the world, to hopefully, you know, guide whether it's disease control mechanisms or urban design or social support structures, to help the billions of people who are actually generating this data in the societies in which they live. So that's what my research direction, and that's what most of this talk is going to be focused on, is the fact that you've got all of this data. In fact, I mean, the vast majority of these digital traces are now coming not from the developed world, but from the developing world, from areas which could really use some help in terms of a wide range of public policy decisions. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're taking this data and seeing how it can be used for good. In terms of a quick summary of this talk, I'm going to go up in orders of magnitude. I'm going to start with talking about giving out phones. That original reality mining study back in 2004, we gave out phones to 100 students, and we showed how you can start doing things like inferring relationships, inferring what the social network looks like based on behavior, but also how that study is now being scaled, where we've got a similar application running on the mobile phones of a group of male sex workers in Mtwapa in Kenya, which happens to be kind of the sex capital of East Africa. And we're looking at whether or not we can start identifying high-risk situations and potentially start planning out interventions appropriately. We're also handing out these phones to a set of on the order of about 250 people in a village called Khalifi, for the onset of a pathogen known as RSV, which is an airborne pathogen, and we're going to see if we can start tracking this over that particular population. When we're expanding this to 1,000 people, it's the same type of thing. We're giving a phone to a client, and now we're, you know, one was a large mobile phone manufacturing company based in Finland. And the other was a group of smokers. And the research question on that last one is, we're just getting started, but the idea is there a behavioral signature associated with relapse for people who have just quit smoking? Can we start figuring out when are people most susceptible to falling off the wagon, so to speak? Scaling to 10,000, again, this is client side. I'm going to be talking a little bit about my work with a company called IMMI, which has taken that original reality mining study and commercialized it and given out phones now to 10,000 randomly sampled people across America. But they're doing something that's really unique and quite scary, I think, especially from the law community. So people might be interested in that. In terms of 100,000, we're working with the police department in Philadelphia, trying to establish whether or not crime is a contagion. So looking at, given the fact that there's a particular neighborhood that had an outbreak of graffiti, does that make them more susceptible to violent crime later on? Can we establish at least temporal correlations associated with crime and find out whether or not a crime wave actually exists? And if a crime wave is true, if it's real, then we should be able to quantify it in terms of its magnitude and its speed. So that's the 100,000 one. When we get into now talking about millions, it's where I'm talking more or less exclusively, well, not quite exclusively, but most of the data is coming from CDR, the mobile phone operators. In one case study, I'll be talking about a data that we have from Rwanda, which represents every phone call made in the country over the last 4 years, coupled with the location of every phone, and what types of questions can be addressed of that data, and how this data can better serve the people that are generating it. When we go to 10 million, it's the same data set, except it's now for Kenya. And beyond just calls, we now have financial transactions. In Kenya, they have something called M-Pesa, which enables people to send and receive money on their phones. And so you can think of these data that phones are generated, it's not just communication, it's not just movement, but now you have an additional edge where you can start tracking financial flows through a particular region. And then at 100 million, this is virtually every phone call made in the UK over the month of August of 2005. And we have a really interesting result here that comes down to looking at the diversity of people's social networks and coupling that with socioeconomic status, indicators like access to healthcare, education levels, average income. we can explain something like close to three quarters of the variance of these outcomes of interest, looking at the entropy of people's egocentric networks. And so I'll close with that. And then, but lastly, you know, so we have data now from a good fraction of a billion people. I think realistically, we'll probably be in the billions in terms of the data that my group has access to by the end of next year. And so once you've got data from billions of people, it's pretty interesting to start thinking about, you know, what does that really mean? And how, again, can we use that data in a way that ultimately improves social good for everybody? Okay? All right, so that's the talk summary. I'm gonna have to go quite quickly. What I'm gonna do is probably skip through a lot of my old PhD stuff and really talk more about the big data and the developing world. And this is a lunchtime talk, right? So people should be interrupting, asking me about privacy and you know how all this data could be used for evil, right?
No one's ever asked you.
Yeah. For the more academic audiences, I tend to start with something like this: people who have been studying social networks for a very long time. The graph on the top is a graph that was generated back in the 30s. This is where people playing cards with each other in a local, I think, electric company. The graph on the bottom is the famous Zachary Karate Club data. The reason why I show this is because there's been, you know, even today, a lot of people, both at my institute, at the Santa Fe Institute, and elsewhere, spend a lot of cognitive energy studying graphs of this magnitude, static small graphs. And while that's well and good, we are now, as a society, inundated. And not just as a society of academics, but most of the examples from this talk are coming from actual problems that people have approached me with. You know, whether they're the urban planners in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, or the police chief in Philadelphia, the civil service in the UK. We're becoming inundated, or at least, you know, these guys, these practitioners, have all this data. And they're trying to make sense of it. And it's this dynamic network of people and that are always changing and changing attributes. And there's more people that enter the network and some people leave the network. And these practitioners are looking to the academic community for help and are understandably a little bit confused when they see that we can really do well at these small static graphs. And that's what we're working on, better methodologies for graphs that really aren't necessarily as relevant and as appropriate to the problems that we're now facing and the problems that this data enables us to start potentially solving. So the one talk takeaway, at least, is the fact that I'd really like to start pushing the academic community away from thinking about generative models that mimic some particular degree distribution. I mean, I like plotting power laws as much as the next guy, and I mean, it's fun to talk about the aggregate behavior of millions of people. But ultimately, I mean, the thing that's important, in my opinion, is to start thinking about outcomes, and whether that's, you know, disease outcomes, crime outcomes, outcomes related to traffic jams. You know, there's these outcomes of interest, and we can think about those outcomes and model them and condition them on the topology. Condition them on the behavior, rather than having it go the other way around. So that's kind of where I'm taking my approach to this is not starting at the topological level and talking about the big data for the big data's sake, but rather talk about the outcomes and perhaps how these particular topological properties from data coming from hundreds of millions of people may yield some insight into understanding what is the underlying dynamic that's driving these outcomes of interest. Okay. All right, so this is now I'm going to start going quite quickly through what I did. This represents about through two and a half to three years of my life, but I'm gonna try to cover it in 5 minutes. So these are our subjects. Essentially for my PhD, what I did was gave out a bunch of phones to 100 people that were just contained Uber spyware. It logged everything. It logged their movement, logged their communication, logged how they used the phone. And what we did was start building models on first on an individual level. So given the fact that S25 is moving up towards Central Square, can we predict where he's going to have dinner? Can we predict who he's going to have dinner with? given the fact the proximity patterns of S27 and S18. If they're often hanging out, having coffee or at these lunchtime talks together, that corresponds to one type of relationship, the relationship that you have with the people in this room. But if S27 and S18 were in downtown Boston on Saturday night at 3 a.m. every Saturday night, you can start thinking about it. They may have a different type of relationship. And then ultimately looking at the aggregate behavior of these groups of people, you can start telling all sorts of interesting things about externalities. So we're capturing data when the Red Sox won the World Series for the first time. And you can see everyone's became unpredictable. Everyone's model broke. In fact, people all flooded into downtown Boston. Some of the urban planners that work for the city are now looking at this data to start seeing how people are using urban infrastructure. How many people who, you know, when they converged into the center of the city, when they wanted to leave, how many people walked across the bridge? How many people rode their bikes? How many people took the T? With this type of data, you can start answering those questions about how people use urban infrastructure. So that was my 3 years. One of the things that I like to talk about, because while I was more or less battling away trying to finish this up, I was kind of reflective about my own life. And when you're spending 16 hours a day in your office staring at a screen, the days start blending in together. And at one point, I was, in fact, actually, it was after coming back from the Santa Fe Institute for the summer school that they had, I got to start thinking about, well, can we start quantifying, you know, how much of my behavior is just so routine and so mundane that I'm not getting any new experiences. So it's, you know, you blink your eye and suddenly a year's gone by and you've got, you know, a set of code that may or may not work. In any case, the hypothesis was perhaps we should start living life in a different way where we want to maximize some function. And the function that that I like to point at is entropy. So being able to start thinking about, you know, high entropic lives versus low entropic lives. And this is an individual, actually I've got his permission now. This is Sandy Pentland. He has a low entropic life. Like, so his life is characterized by dropping off his kids and picking up his kids. So this is, you know, home, work, home. You can see the bands associated with weekends. This is my office mate, who's a grad student at the time, now a very successful entrepreneur. And you have to squint pretty hard to see the patterns in his schedule. So this is someone who's highly entropic, meaning it's a lot easier to predict what Sandy's going to do than what Mike is going to do. And you can start categorizing entropy through demographics. So the freshmen, the individuals at MIT are 18 years old. They just arrive on campus. We hand them a phone. They're much more entropic than, for example, the staff at the Media Lab, who work typically 9 to 5. I'm going to skip the eigenbehavior stuff. But one thing that's interesting, and I kind of alluded to it earlier when I was talking about being proximate in downtown Boston at Saturday nights, was can you start using this behavioral data to infer friendships, to infer the structure of a social network? So this is the structure of what looks like, this is, I think, 24 hours of proximity. So if you're proximate at all, and in 24 hours, you get an edge. How do you winnow this graph down to get at what the actual friendship graph is?
Well, how would you define friendship?
So friendship, that's a good question. Friendship, as it's defined, By most social network people, is ground truth is surveys. You give people surveys. You ask them if they're in your circle of friends. If they say yes, that's absolutely true. If they say no, that's absolutely not true. There's a problem with this, right? And that's actually something that we talk about in a paper that just was recently published. So this is what the survey data said, and we built a little model that started using things like proximity on Saturday nights, proximity at home, whether you travel together, the amount of communication you have, those types of dyadic variables to infer what we expect is the social network.
Would you have it infer the screen?
Exactly. So you see it weighted ties here. Yeah,
so
no longer is friendship a binary variable, but we can actually start assessing what the strength of the friendship is. And there's some reasonable similarities and some differences associated with the graph, but one of the points that we make in this paper is the fact that when people are filling out these surveys, even just about who are you proximate to, their response is barely correlated with actual data, right? So, and people are much more likely to say I'm proximate to a friend, and much less likely to report true proximity to someone who they don't have a relationship with. This isn't because people are giving us bogus, purposefully giving us bogus information. It's just because, when people are filling out these surveys, they're not necessarily cognizant of a lot of the behavior that they may already have. And this is particularly important in this, in this era of swine flu H1N1, when people are asked to report, who are you nearby? It turns out people's reports are horrendously bad at that sort of thing. Okay, so that was my PhD. We're now deploying the same system with a group of a dozen male sex workers who, for the last couple of years, have been filling out diaries every day about their activities. And so one of the things that we're particularly interested in now is, and this is a collaboration with Dr. Ed Sanders at the Kenyon Medical Research Institute. One of the things that we're interested in is these co-location activities. When three or more of these guys are in the same place at the same time, especially on times like Saturday nights, there's a very high probability that there's a needle sharing event that is occurring or is about to occur. We can, in almost real time, get information about when these guys on the other side of the world are becoming proximate. And in virtually real time, we can start pushing them content on their phones. So there's a potential here to talk about interventions, identifying high-risk behavior, and then doing something about it. This is still very much a work in progress, but I think that's what I'd like to see this type of client-side, the Uber spyware type software be used for, because I think it could add a lot of value. With Dr. James Noakes, we're looking at how RSV spreads over a group of, I think, on the order of about 50 households. And we're combining the mobile phones with RFIDs to start looking at proximity. And he's taking, every other day, I believe, he's taking swabs and measuring people to check whether or not they're infected with this particular pathogen. The nice thing about the pathogen is that it's not particularly dangerous. But this is the first time that I'm aware that this type of tracking technology has been used for legitimate epidemiological research. The kids aren't. That's why RFIDs. So it's the RFID is basically slapped onto their school badge, which they need to go to school. The older kids love the phones, but the younger kids, it's been a mistake giving them those phones in the past.
Yeah. What happens to it,
yeah. With a group of researchers in New York, we're looking at there's a smoking quit line, and we've got some money from the NIH now to randomly sample people who are calling this quit line and give them a set of phones if they're so inclined to participate. And the research question here is, like, is there a behavioral signature associated with relapse? With individuals who have quit and are trying to stay, maintain their smoke-free lifestyle, we're going to be periodically pushing surveys to these phones, asking them about cravings, questions about relapse. And what we want to do is build up a model to start seeing when are people most likely to relapse. Once you can identify when the potential relapse is going to occur, we can start talking about interventions. So as we're expanding now into the thousands, we've got a research project where we gave out the same phones and now are trying to infer not just friendship, this binary variable asking people whether or not you're friends, but can we actually infer the relationship that people have with each other? And so with this data, we have on the order of about 15,000 labeled relationships with temporal elements, spatial elements, and contextual elements. And we're building a classifier that can figure out whether or not someone's an acquaintance, a colleague, family, friends. This is temporal patterns associated with each of the types of relationship. And as you can see, they overlap substantially. And so this particular PhD student is going to is struggling actually trying to build the right machine learning classifier. You may have seen this one. This is Sandy Pentland loves to show this. And I think ultimately, while CAB data is potentially interesting, and this is certainly beautiful, I think one of the things that I've been speaking with to the CDC quite often is something very different than what Sense Networks are trying to do. It comes back. The idea originally was from a guy named Ron Hoffield, who came up with this project called Backtrack. Are people familiar with this? It's a fundamentally brilliant idea. I absolutely love it. The idea is quite simple. Let's have that. All right. So what you saw was this time going forward. What Ron is suggesting is you can drive time backward. So if you had a bunch of this trace data from a set of population, a group of people, and say randomly distributed throughout San Francisco, people are starting to become symptomatic with flu-like symptoms, but they're all over the city. I mean, how could we figure out where the disease actually started from? What you do is you run people's trajectories backwards in time. And if you start seeing that the same, the individuals who are expressing symptoms were all at the same place, all at the same time, you can get a pretty good idea of where that ground zero was. And more importantly, you can identify the individuals who are also co-located there, but are not yet symptomatic. And that is gold for the CDC. This is a project that got its funding cuts when DARPA did a bunch of horrible things with Rumsfeld. I mean, basically, the press got wind of some predictive analytics type proposal, and then they cut everything. So, but I think the idea has legs, and someone needs to do it. And I think I'm working with the Ministry of Health in Rwanda to do something vaguely similar. The IMMI data, I'm going to quickly go through this as well. But this is the thing that I think that some of you may be interested in. How many people have heard of IMMI? All right, so IMMI, they're another amazing company. Nielsen just tried to do a hostile takeover of IMMI and failed. They just raised $50 million, I believe, from Draper. What they do is they give out phones with this Uber spyware to a random sample of 10,000 people. But they're using one additional sensor that I was not able to touch in the reality mining study. I could not turn that sensor on. Do people have an idea of what sensor I'm talking about? What sensor legally would I not be able to turn on? Yeah. So these guys are turning on the microphones of 10,000 phones randomly distributed across America and sampling the ambient audio environment. And what they've got, I'm sure people have heard of this app on the iPhone that you hold your phone up to the radio and you get a text message back with the name of the song that's playing. All right. So the guy who started that came out, did his PhD at Stanford in this acoustics matchmaking. And what he realized was the money is not necessarily in telling people what song is playing. The money is telling advertisers what media are people consuming. So what IMMI can do is they can figure out, whether I'm playing my favorite MP3 in my car on my way to work, whether I'm in the cinema, whether I'm at home, whether I'm at the sports bar. ESPN loves these guys because ESPN gets screwed by Nielsen, because everyone goes to the sports bar to watch the game, and ESPN can't get the ratings. So with this type of system, it's a much better they're much more accurate at figuring out what people are actually doing. And the other thing that's interesting, I guess full disclosure, I do consult for them. But I honestly do think that what they're doing is amazing. It's that they've got a system that can figure out efficacy of marketing campaigns. What they found out during when the Simpsons movie was in the theaters, they showed that people were much more likely to actually go to the movie theater and see the Simpsons movie if they saw the Burger King co-branded TV ad rather than the actual Simpsons trailer. So that Burger King ad drove more people to the theaters than the ad that was just the ad for the movie. And there's no way you'd be able to get that type of information unless you had a system that that ultimately has the potential to really violate a lot of privacy concerns. This is crime in Philadelphia. This is from the police department there. The red cars are carjackings. The martini glass is a public drunkenness. The RX symbols are drug busts. Over the course of the year, the question here is: does a crime wave exist? If a crime wave exists, we should be able to figure out how it spreads over a city and ultimately start talking about being able to predict crime. If a crime wave exists and it's something that we can identify in real-time data, we should be able to know when the next criminal events are going to occur and where they're going to occur. And that's, it turns out it's a lot harder, of much harder problem than I originally anticipated. There's a lot of issues around, whether or not smoking is contagious, acne is contagious, height is contagious. You can show things are contagions without really showing that they're contagions. And so this is ongoing work with a group of very interesting people, both in the police force as well as physicists and epidemiologists. All right, so that now brings me to the developing world. I strongly urge people to go to ai-d.org. Artificial Intelligence for Development. It's officially a nonprofit, but we're kicking it off with the AAAI, the main artificial intelligence academic body, is really kicking it off in March at Stanford. So March 23rd through 24th, we're having the annual AAAI symposium at Stanford is going to be on artificial intelligence for development. And we're soliciting papers from a wide range of different fields. And so please, if you're interested in participating, contact me. Because I think we're at a point now, and I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, where the majority of this type of data, whether it's cell phone data, whether it's financial transaction data, the majority of this data is coming from the developing world, the world that, the regions that really could use the help the most. And so I think this is a fun excuse to do some interesting math, but make it really count. Oh, so I've alluded to CDR, what call data records represent. CDR is this digital trace that you leave behind anytime you use your phone. And CDR, you have the caller and receiver of the particular call in this case, the time and the duration the call started, and then perhaps most interestingly, you have the cell towers associated with that call. And in terms of duration, we have data from different operators ranging from 1 month up to now 5 years. And in terms of the percent of the population that we're getting information from, anywhere between 5% and 100% of the population, plus or minus one maybe. But it's very comprehensive, very detailed, and not beyond just looking at calls and text messages. Some of the things that we found most interesting, especially in an East African context, is things like airtime transfers. So looking at how people are sending and receiving airtime. There's please call me free text, so you can actually push a free text message to someone to get them to call you. It's free to receive calls. It's free to receive text messages. There's an interesting dynamic when you look at a directed graph, right? So you can actually start seeing, to some degree, who's willing to pay for the communication, or who's able to pay for the communication. I mentioned M-Pesa in the beginning. I'm going to talk about M-Pesa at the very end of this talk, too. M-Pesa is this infrastructure that enables people to send and receive actual money. No longer airtime, but you can actually send money. And what's brilliant is, from my laptop here in the Berkman Center, I can send money to any of the 15 million phones in Kenya right now. So I can push money to them, and they will receive that money within 5 minutes. There's something profoundly empowering here, and I'll talk about it at the very end. But it's a very exciting time to do cell phone related work in East Africa. We're doing the other types of data that you get access to are things like scratch card top ups, and we're using the scratch card. So all this market is completely prepaid. So when you go to a place like Tanzania or Rwanda or Kenya, you want to use your phone. You get a SIM card, and the SIM card costs virtually nothing. And then you can buy a scratch card in denominations, anywhere between 25 cents up to $25. And so what we're using is the denomination of the scratch card to infer socioeconomic status. So we had two individual users. They both more or less make the same types of calls and amount of calls. One buys the 25-cent card over and over and over again. One buys the $10 card. We can start inferring who has more disposable income. This has been a fun project with Eric Horvitz at Microsoft Research. What we have here is, and it's kind of silly until I show the next slide, but what we have here is an earthquake detector. So we can actually detect an earthquake using CDR. And the way we can do that is we have a Bayesian anomaly detection algorithm that goes through, and we build baseline estimates for the amount of incoming and outgoing traffic for each cell tower in Rwanda, right? And then as we go through time, we look to see for deviations from that baseline behavior. And this is the Namasheke earthquake, February 2nd, I believe. What we can do is, based on the magnitude of the deviation, we can triangulate where the epicenter of the earthquake was. So you know, there's not a big market for kind of post hoc earthquake detection. But this type of algorithm can be used in a disease surveillance context. So I spent about a month and a half ago, I was in the basement of the president of Mexico's house. The basement is where his chief of staff operates out of. And what they are interested in is the onset of flu season. And so one of the things that we've been working on with the Mexican government and in collaboration with Telefonica is doing disease surveillance on mobile phones. And so we pushed out something like a million USSD surveys asking people if they had the onset of flu-like symptoms. And we got a response that matched fairly well the epidemic curve. But the interesting thing is that what we're trying to do here, from a machine learning perspective, is to get labels. So we've got this data from Telefonica representing 10 million individuals across the country. What we want to build is a disease surveillance mechanism. So what we want to do is look on an individual level, you know, who's deviating from their behavior in such a way that's indicative of a potential onset of flu-like symptoms. So we can characterize individuals in their normal movements, their normal communication patterns. But then when people deviate, especially if the people are all in some particular region, what we want to do is be able to red flag the Ministry of Health saying, hey, something's going on here. Like, people are now behaving like they're potentially just got sick. And these types of deviations don't necessarily have to be the onset of flu-like symptoms. I've got one of the students, a doctoral candidate I'm advising at Berkeley, he just got back from Kigali where he was doing surveys. So we've got this call data, and then what he's doing is asking people, you know, where in the past have they experienced some shock, whether it's a financial shock, it could be a shock related to a death in the family, market crash, what have you. And then what we're looking for is trying to identify signatures associated with these different shocks in the individual CDR. Amy was an REU, so she's a theoretical mathematician who's now going to be applying to MIT and Harvard. What we worked on over the summer was building a generative model of a slum. So Kibera is the largest slum in the world. And when you look at studies on slums, generally Kibera is brought up. And if you look at in detail about the data coming from studies in slums, it's they get anywhere between up to a dozen people walking around with clipboards, interviewing people, asking people self-report data about where they're from, socioeconomic status, crime, what have you. And while that data is well and good, I think we can do a better job given the fact that 30% of the population of Kibera is now carrying around a phone, and that trajectory is in this data set, we can start looking at how Kibera is affecting people's lives. We can not only see how people are growing, which neighborhoods people are going into in the slum, and which neighborhoods people are leaving, and what tribes are they from. But the interesting thing is that we can actually start looking at whether or not the slum is doing its job. So by being able to infer socioeconomic status based on the scratch card denominations, what we can start doing is we can see, you know, what we can infer someone's socioeconomic status when they enter the slum, and then we can infer their socioeconomic status when they leave the slum. And we can identify regions in Nairobi and elsewhere in the country that are springboards economically. Not only that, but we can actually start, so we can quantify whether or not it's working, but then also quantify how it's growing over time. I mean, and this is now working with some of the folks in Nairobi that are in charge of, they have very limited resources that they can allocate to slum development. So these guys need to figure out, where do you put in the next latrines? Where do you put in the next infrastructure? You know, where is the next area of growth going to be? We haven't had any real results yet, but I think we have the potential with this data to answer those types of questions. Very briefly, this is another student we're working on how the social structure is changing over time. So this is now with Rwanda. With 4 years of data, you can actually start looking at how communities form and how communities disappear over the course of that period of time, and then looking at what are correlated with communities that persist over time versus communities of people. And then when I'm talking about communities, I'm talking about communities in a social network perspective. So you've got the topology of this graph, and this graph is changing over time as people are calling different people. And you can segment that graph into different cliques or communities. And then you can start looking at how those communities of people are changing. And what's interesting is the communities that persist over the years tend to be made up of people who buy high denomination scratch cards, people who we infer to have high socioeconomic status. The communities that initially form and then disappear almost immediately are then, you know, the other larger fraction of the population. I spent the most of the morning with Marta Gonzalez today, and one of the things that we're applying for a fairly large NSF grant to start looking at, I hesitate using the word universal law of human anything, but I think the NSF might like that, hopefully. The idea is we've got all this data of movement patterns across all these different countries, and we're looking for pattern. What are the universal patterns of how people move around their own community? This is a fun project. This is actually the first collaboration I've had with my wife. My wife is joining, she's becoming an assistant professor at Harvard next year, and she's a computational epidemiologist. And one of the things that we're working on, the research question, is that Bill Gates, amongst others, has allocated over $10 million to malaria eradication in parts of Kenya. And then specifically, it's this particular part that people are most concerned with. And what we're trying to do, in collaboration with Bob Snow and Neil Ferguson, is figure out whether it's even possible. Is eradication of malaria possible in this particular region, given the fact, conditioned on the mobility of other people across Africa who are coming from malaria-infected regions? So if there's enough people coming onto this Kenyan coast that are infected with malaria, you're never going to be able to do complete eradication, and that the money that you spend on trying to could be better used in other ways. And so there's a threshold about how many people coming from these particular locations going to the coast. If that number is above a threshold, then eradication is impossible. And so I think this is another good example of how this type of data can be used, in this case, for disease control policy. So now we're going up to N equals 100 million. And this takes me back to entropy. What we've found, what I think is just a striking result, is that we can account for socioeconomic status. So we have this aggregate metric of socioeconomic status, and it comes down to access to healthcare, education levels, and average income, more or less. And this is for the UK. Now we're using virtually the vast majority of phone calls made in the UK for a particular month. And what we're looking at now is the egocentric and entropy levels of the graph, and correlating that with our socioeconomic status, the access to income, education levels, and healthcare. And what we found is we can explain.
Sorry, how do you get that information?
This is collaboration with the UK Civil Service, and in the telco data, this is so the BT, the operator, they are the incumbent operator, which means that they lay down all the switches for the country. So if you make a phone call, more likely than not, it's routed through a BT switch.
Socioeconomic
status of the UK Civil Service.
Link it to individuals?
So this is that's a good question. We link it to groups of about 2,000 people. So it's okay. Broken down into kind of a census level districts, and so we assume everyone. And so that brings up a good point. There is some variance associated with those 2,000 people, but the districts have been created in such a way that the UK Civil Service is trying to minimize that variance.
Okay.
Even if there is variance, the fact that we get a correlation this high shows that the variance can't be that big. So the point of the matter is just that it's not the amount of time that you spend on the phone that correlates with your socioeconomic status. It's not your degree. It's not the number of friends you've got, but rather it's the diversity of friends you've got. This comes back to Granovetter. So Granovetter is this he's a sociologist from Stanford. He has this idea of the strength of weak ties. The fact that your next job is not going to be coming from your best friend or your neighbor. Your next job is you're going to find out about it through a weak tie. And what this has done is this has validated one of the most famous theories in social science. So I hope it gets published somewhere. So now that I'm going to kind of transition a little bit to this work I was doing in this rural hospital in Kilifi. So Kilifi is out on the coast of Kenya, and it's beautiful place, but it also has the highest endemic rate of malaria in the world, which makes it an interesting place to study. I was there because my wife was studying malaria, and as an IT guy, they needed someone to help with the computers, and so I this was actually the only place that had air conditioning in the entire village. So I managed to score an office in this hospital, but by scoring an office in this hospital, it also meant that give you a little background on Kilifi. Beyond just having being a beautiful place and having high malaria, it's between Mombasa in the south and Malindi in the north, and there are these big vans of people called matatus that race up and down the coast delivering people back and forth between Mombasa and Malindi. And while Kilifi is a small town, occasionally when these vans have accidents, they're inundated with patients that desperately need blood transfusions. And so what we've built is a system that connects these local district hospitals along the Kenyan coast with the central Mombasa blood repository. And so these guys working at the centralized blood bank can get daily updates about what the blood levels are in these local hospitals. And this is important because typically, before this system was implemented, they drive around the coast once a month checking to see what the blood levels are. And then if the blood level is below a certain threshold, then the next month they come in and they do the resupply, right? So there's such latency in the system that another more background about me, I have a real problem with needles. When I started working in this hospital, I was periodically approached saying, look, we desperately need your blood. There's been an accident. When this happened over and over again to a point where I had a continual bruise on my arm, I started looking into this. So we built this system that enables the nurses to text in what the current blood levels are for each day. And then I had a student, Eric Magatu, built this beautiful visualization showing what the real-time blood levels were on the Kenyan coast. And this system was a total failure. Like, it did not work at all. We had the guys in the central blood bank using it, they were logging in, but the data wasn't changing. After the first couple of days, the nurses stopped texting in what the blood levels were. And the reason they did this is because a text message represents a substantial fraction of a day's wage for a rural nurse. And so the way we countered this problem is we added, literally it was 15 lines of code to our SMS gateway. And with those 15 lines of code, what they did was if we received a properly formatted blood text message from that day, we would credit the nurse with 4 shillings of airtime back to her phone. And that was 15 lines of code, flipped a switch. And suddenly, the nurses all wanted to participate in it, and we're getting really good data, and it's now actually under review by the Kenyan Ministry of Health for nationwide deployment. And so this got us thinking, what other types of work can we get people to do out in these rural areas? We suddenly have a mechanism now to compensate people. Beyond just asking them what the current blood levels are at their hospital, there's got to be other sets of tasks that these people can do. And it turns out there are billions of these types of tasks that companies will pay people to do. That was started Text Eagle. I'm actually giving a Text Eagle talk to an audience of about 250 people at 6 p.m. today. So if you guys want to hear more about Text Eagle, you should go to that talk. But essentially what it is it's a mobile crowdsourcing platform that enables people to do work and earn money on their phones. And we're deployed in Kenya, we're deploying in Rwanda, we've got it actually now live in Mexico. There's a wide range of things that are interesting, but you also need a lot of math. Basically, our clients are not paying us for the response of what does a Kenyan think about whether or not this image is porn or whether or not, whatever, the different types of work that we've got. They're paying for the correct answer. And so using what's called expectation maximization, we've built, a fairly elegant system that can not only infer the accuracy of a given response, but also the expertise of a given user in a simultaneous way. And I don't know, I'm pretty proud. I think this is a great example of where math has really made a difference. I mean, we are now on track to becoming the largest employer in Kenya. We'll be the largest employer by the end of this year. Text Eagle is a multi-million-dollar corporation. And frankly, we're doing something that I think I'm personally really proud of. I mean, I think fundamentally this is, while I love the science angle, this is really having an impact. And I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to transform the phones of 15 million East Africans into a platform that enables them to earn money.
America or
no? For a couple reasons. One, the first reason is that people talk about technological leapfrogging, right? So I was in Kenya about a month ago, and I didn't have to save any shillings on my way to the airport. To pay the taxi cab driver, I paid them with my mobile phone, right? So through M-Pesa. Now, I was going to San Jose, the heart of Silicon Valley. I arrive in San Jose, I have my fancy iPhone. There is no way that cab driver would accept payment from my iPhone to get to my hotel. Right, so it's fundamentally, the Kenyan technology has surpassed what we could do in the States. Like, there isn't an easy way. Like, how am I going to send 10 cents to any of the 100 million phones in the country? That infrastructure isn't in place yet, whereas it is in Kenya. So, as we look forward, I mean, this is now a list of the countries that I'm working with operators in, and this list seems to be ever growing. We can start talking about what happens when you can aggregate all this data across cultures, across continents. What we're finding is, I mean, it may be close to universal laws. I mean, what Marta and I have been looking at, it seems like people in the Dominican Republic move in very similar ways to the people in Rwanda, which bears striking resemblance to how people in San Francisco move. There's particular types of information that diffuse over a village in Kenya in exactly the same way it diffuses through Greater London. So while we do have the potential to start talking about universal laws of human behavior, and the people I work with at the Santa Fe Institute love this notion of people as particles and talk about the physics of society or sociophysics, I think ultimately the harder question is not necessarily parameterizing this data, fitting some degree distribution, building a generative model. The harder question is, how can we leverage this data and these insights to better serve the billions of people that are generating this data? So ultimately, that's a question of engineering, in my opinion, as an engineer. I think we can do some interesting social science, and the physicists can get involved in terms of the modeling. But ultimately, what we want to do is figure out how this data can be better used, whether it's for disease, whether it's for crime, whether it's for social support structures. We need to design something. We need to engineer something, and so now is really the time for engineers. And with that, this is a list of section of the people that I collaborate with, both my students, collaborators, people who work in industry, et cetera. And I'd love to expand this list as well. So for people who are interested in this type of research, I've got many more open projects that I didn't have time to talk about today, but I'm always happy to add to that list, because this is it's an exciting time to do this type of work. Thank you.
Great. We have time for questions, so we can bleed over. So please.
Did you ever interact with the Sensible City Group?
Yeah, I know Carlo. Yeah. But we definitely interact. In fact, actually, one of his former students worked with me for over the summer. So we do student swaps.
How is the question of privacy some of these projects are much more invasive than others.
Yeah.
How is this? Are these things being passed on by regulations that do exist in these countries and are more flexible than would be in other countries? How is that going?
So as far as every country that I put up on that board, And America is included in this, as long as the data is properly de-identified, meaning the phone numbers are hashed and you don't have latitude and longitude, but rather you have kind of some general area, this is legal. So it doesn't come into the legislation aspects aren't what's guiding which data we have and which data we don't have. And across the board, the reason for the anonymization, a lot of times it's the operator, but in some of the operators we work with, they're willing just to give us real phone numbers, essentially. And that is the last thing we want, because once you have real phone numbers, suddenly you're opening yourself up for a whole bunch of liability. I mean, the data could be subpoenaed, and there's all sorts of problems. So, to answer your question, the regulatory issues with the different countries don't come into play for this.
And how about, do you have, people that actually have complained or, on the moral side, that people think that this would be an ethic to, turn on a mic or something?
The microphone is a different story. Yeah, so I was talking about my data. That data is not IRB approved. The IMMI data is not IRB approved. You're recording audio, and they're talking about recording audio features, but at the end of the day, that's something that... is potentially illegal, but
just to build on that, we talked a lot with Sandy about it, about rich data and how you've anonymized, but you can re-identify.
Yep.
Because it's so rich,
mm-hmm.
And you have and actually AT&T is a big sponsor of Sensible City Day, and they're everyone recognizes its enormous potential. This data in the U.S. and Europe is even stronger,
mm-hmm.
But you are going to. I mean, that there are issues around that.
Absolutely.
And you can't. I mean, the hashing.
And that's
the richer, the more powerful. One of the things we're interested in the Law Lab is how to develop a whole set of mechanisms and governance, the ways of engineering governance, security, and privacy, and through zero knowledge proofs in a variety of ways, which you can utilize this data, but not have it leak out.
Yeah,
and I would assume that these are a lot of poor African countries that can make use of it, but I think here
there's precedent. I mean, if people know about the ad health data set, all right, there's these I think they figured they have a potential solution in the medical field that a lot of computer scientists aren't necessarily aware of. I mean, it's not a complete solution, but they give away this data, this ad health data to thousands of researchers around the country. And it's data that's very private, very personal, about IQ levels and test scores and potential for genetic diseases.
Right.
But this data exists, and
who does this?
I think the NIH runs the program, but that's.
And they anonymize.
They anonymize it, but they are very aware that because it's so rich that.
You could identify it.
That
could be a matter of time.
Yeah.
I think this is it's very, very important. What you do, I think this is great, great stuff. So, but I just think that when you try to scale it and institutionalize it in some sense, you get.
Sorry. I agree. I mean, it's the reason I'd love to have to do. I mean, so the reason why I'm known to some degree in the computer science department is not because of these models of human behavior. The reason why I'm known is because I made the reality mining data set available to researchers. It's been downloaded something like 4,500 times. It's generated over 100 journal publications, and made my papers fairly well cited. I would love to do a comparable with the CDR data. I'd love to be able to release at least some of it to the academic community at large. And the reason why I can't is because of this
right.
issue with rich data and
right.
the potential for. But I think, I think there's a really great field of work around how do we structure it, have this data in a way that it's absolutely impossible to.
And that's one that we're interested in doing with Circus, which is the group here at Harvard in the computer science department.
Okay.
So we should talk about it.
Health maps. No.
It's an iPhone application that allows people to upload whether they're sort of different diseases they have. It's an iPhone application called Health Maps.
Okay. Yeah. I think we'll certainly see more of that, and I bet that data is useful. But there is something to be said about random samples. So being able to that Mexico sample where we sampled 1 million people randomly, we pushed a survey to their phone. We only got something like 70,000 people who responded to that survey, and so we're not really getting that random sample either. But when you're just looking at iPhone users, or specifically just looking at people who would install an application that would let them report their diseases, I don't know.
Isn't there some inherent bias in who's willing to accept a free phone?
Oh, there's inherent bias in all this stuff. Yeah, absolutely. It's so that's one of the reasons why we did MIT students, because it's a really fancy multimedia phone, and like and it wouldn't necessarily work as well in other groups. But there's always going to be bias, and the question is, you know, we are trying to minimize it, really. Yeah.
Can you say more about assessing the expertise of the people you're
working with? Oh, cool. Yeah, of course. So it's a very simple system, right? So Nokia is a client. Nokia's really big on personalization, and there's something like 30 unique languages in Kenya alone. In the village I was living on the coast, people spoke Giriama, and maybe English is a second language, then Kiswahili was their third language. And Nokia would love a Giriama interface. But the problem is they don't know how to translate the word address book into Giriama. And so what we do is we send a set of individuals who live out on the Kenyan coast the same task. Please translate the word address book into Giriama. And then we get a set of responses back. And the first thing we need to do is figure out what the right answer is. And so if everyone is giving us the same answer back, we can assume with some 95% confidence interval that, yes, that is the correct answer. And once you can figure out what the correct answer is, you can start building up reputation models of individuals based on how often do you give us the correct spelling for a particular word in Giriama? How often do you give us the correct tag for a particular image? So you can be experts in particular domains. And so people don't have a general expertise, but you know they're really good at translating Giriama and Kikuyu, right? But not so good at Lua. So we can start assessing people, how good people are for what particular tasks, and then we push the tasks. So people don't get to choose what work they do. Our model pushes the appropriate tasks to the appropriate people.
Who these people are, you just know them by their phone.
I know them by what they say in their registration, but most importantly, I know them by the work that they do in terms of the accuracy of it. So the people who don't give us accurate results over a period of a couple of days, they don't get to use the system anymore. Oh. Yeah.
Did you say that you used the Amazon Mechanical Turk for that? You matched your
No. So mechanical. This is a mobile Mechanical Turk, but we serve many more tasks than MTurk because of the price point.
And so, when some researchers here had done some work with Mechanical Turk, and they got a lot of pushback from the non-computer scientists about the sort of race to the bottom in terms of wages, are you able to, I'm just wondering sort of your sense of how much is...
There's always an exploitation angle to this, right? Like, we're getting people to work for anywhere between 70 cents and $1.30 an hour. But ultimately, driving on that cab ride back to the airport, going past guys who are digging ditches on the side of the road, they make in a day on the order of about $2, $2 to $2.50 a day for digging ditches. And in fact, they have to have a phone. Day labor is organized via SMS in that part of Nairobi. So they've got the phone. They're doing manual labor for $2 a day. We can give them something that enables them to double their wage in 2 hours. So I think, sure, that you could spin it as exploitation, but ultimately we're giving people a platform that enables them to pursue other economic opportunities if they're so inclined.
We're running behavioral economics type experiments on Amazon Mechanical Turk.
Yeah.
Here's a dollar, how much do you want to give to this random other Turker?
Okay.
And so I think a big area of interest in that sort of social science research right now is cross-cultural differences.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems like a sort of amazingly powerful tool for doing some things like that, also in a reasonably inexpensive way, if.
It is, and I'm not interested.
Okay.
And the reason is simply because for this is now a commercial enterprise. Like, this is not for research. And unfortunately, your pockets aren't nearly as deep as Google and Nokia, and those are the clients that we need to pay attention to, because ultimately whether this lives or dies is going to be coming back to how many tasks we can get, and those tasks aren't going to come from the academics.
Mm-hmm. Is it also then that Google going to become like a bit of like a financial institution for underserved, given that
we recently raised a significant amount of money from the Royal Bank of Canada, and the reason is because our partnerships with local banks. You can start, as you're acquiring money, as you're accumulating money, well, we can do things like provide people with interest. We can provide people like a savings bond. We can give people, like, the vast majority of our users don't have a bank account. And most of them don't know what interest even is. So we're introducing them to these concepts of financial services. And then when their account reaches a certain threshold, we give them the opportunity to transfer that money into an actual physical bank account in Nairobi with Equity Bank. And so this is a kind of a platform where, like, what the reason why the banking industry is investing in us is they see us as a bridge between people who are completely unbanked and more traditional financial services. And what we can do is we can offer these financial services without being regulated like a bank. And the beauty of this is that we don't take people's money. We don't take deposits. And because we don't take money, we're a financial creditor. And as such, we don't have to deal with all the legislation associated with the banking industry in Africa.
Again, I'd like to thank you very much for a very stimulating presentation.